Chapter 14. Easter Island. Circa 1150 to 1838. Captain Jacob Roggeveen had been at sea for 247 days. He had set sail from the Netherlands the year before with three ships, Arendt, Tynhoven, Afrikanische Galley, and 223 hands, and had reached the Falkland Islands by the 30th of December. From there, they rounded Cape Horn in wild seas, docked in Chile for a time, and then sailed west, out into the next great uncharted frontier for colonial exploration, the South Pacific. He and his crew were searching for a hypothetical continent known as Terra Australis, which was believed to lie in the southern seas, somewhere south of Australia. But so far, their hopes had been in vain. "We have now come about 500 miles to the westward of Copiapo, situated on the coast of Chile," he wrote in his journal on the 2nd of April, 1722, "and yet not come in sight of the unknown Southland, according to existing accounts of it, for the discovery of which our expedition and voyage is specially undertaken. Ahead of them lay nothing but flat, open sea. Breeze unsteady with calms," he writes. "Also thick weather and showers. Saw a turtle, floating weed and birds." Then one day they sighted a scrap of land breaking the line of the horizon. It was Easter Day, 1722. "There was great rejoicing among the people," wrote Roggeveen, "and everyone hoped that this low land might prove to be a foretoken of the coastline of the unknown southern continent. As the Dutch mariners got closer, they saw smoke rising from villages along the coast, from which we concluded that there were people dwelling on the same. It soon became clear that this was not the tip of a continent, but just a small island, a dot in the middle of the ocean. Still, the Dutch were curious. It was a seemingly barren land, the slopes covered in rough grass, and, from its outward appearance, it suggested no other idea than that of an extraordinarily sparse and meagre vegetation. The weather was very variable, with thunder, sheet lightning, and showers," remembers Roggeveen. "The wind unsteady from the northwest, and occasional calms. When the Arendt and Tynhoven drew near to the shore, the island's inhabitants came out to the ships on canoes, greeting the Dutch crew with friendly astonishment. Roggeveen went ashore, and what he found there amazed him. Along the beach was a line of enormous stone statues, lined up in rows with their backs to the sea. They were carved from black volcanic stone, some of them standing 10 meters high, and topped with crowns of red sandstone. These stone figures caused us to be filled with wonder, for we could not understand how it was possible that people who are destitute of heavy or thick timber, and also of stout cordage out of which to construct gear, had been able to erect them. Nevertheless, some of these statues were a good 30 feet in height and broad in proportion." Roggeveen and his men didn't stay long. After a few days, they sailed away from the island and on across the Pacific, in search of a continent that would never materialize. But the remarkable sight of those stone statues stayed with them, a source of wonder and puzzlement. Roggeveen even began to imagine how productive this island could one day be, if Europeans were able to make a permanent settlement. "This place," he mused, "as far as its rich soil and good climate are concerned, is such that it might be made into an earthly paradise if it were properly worked and cultivated." Unknown to him, the century that followed would see unimaginable devastation rain down on this island, and every one of its remarkable stone statues would be toppled and left to lie, windswept and forlorn, on these grassy hills. The Pacific Ocean is vast. It covers one-third of the Earth's total surface area, larger than the landmass of all its continents combined. Across this expanse of blue sea are scattered more than 30,000 islands of varying size. Easter Island is at the eastern corner of an area called the Polynesian Triangle, an expanse of water nearly the size of Asia, dotted with more than 1,000 small volcanic islands, averaging only about 30 to 40 square kilometers each. Easter Island itself is a loosely triangular shape, made up of 3 extinct volcanoes at each of its points. It is small, only about 24 kilometers from end to end, and it is more than 2,000 kilometers from the nearest inhabited island. With its bleak, grass-grown surface, its wild rocks and restless ocean, it recalls some of the Scilly Isles, or the coast of Cornwall, wrote the archaeologist Catherine Routledge when she visited in 1913. From every part are seen marvelous views of rolling country. Everywhere is the wind of heaven. Around and above all are boundless sea and sky, infinite space and a great silence. The dweller there is ever listening for he knows not what, feeling unconsciously that he is in the antechamber to something yet more vast, which is just beyond his ken. The people who have lived on Easter Island for centuries call it by the name Te Pito o Te Henua, which means either land's end or navel of the world, depending on translation. And today's Polynesians call the island Rapa Nui. The Polynesians who first settled the island arrived from the west, having left the mainland of the Asian continent sometime before 3000 BCE and gradually island-hopped all the way across the ocean. In Polynesian mythology, this ancient homeland is remembered as Hawaiki, or Hiva. These hardy sailors were some of the most successful ocean-going settlers in history. They built sophisticated, sturdy canoes with 2 hulls, double masts and sails, making them both stable and fast, and capable of covering great distances. The spirit of this age is captured in one traditional Polynesian fisherman's prayer. O mighty being, moving freely in the broken fragments of the rainbow, go before me upon this day. May you become a support, ever lifting our ship high above the wind-tossed crests of the surging seas, as we sail upon our double-hulled vessel over the wide ways of the ocean, so that we sink not beneath the hurrying waves. These early settlers navigated the oceans without any physical navigation devices or written notes. They could determine their location using only the stars, and memorized these astral positions and those of islands and sea routes with unwritten stories and songs. They also used natural cues to help them navigate, including the flight paths of seabirds, like the black, white, and brown tern. This ancient Polynesian sailor's song shows the importance that these birds held in Polynesian culture. Mine is the migrating bird, winging afar over remote oceans, ever pointing out the sea road of the black heron, the dark cloud in the sky of night. It is the road of the winds, coursed by the sea kings to unknown lands. Storms in the Pacific could be deadly to these early explorers, but when a severe typhoon struck, they had a survival method that seems unthinkable to a modern sailor. They would purposely flood their canoes, the wooden hulls providing enough buoyancy to stay afloat, while the part-submerged boat could survive being buffeted about in the gale-force winds without overturning. The sailors would climb inside the flooded hulls, keeping their heads above water, and wait for the storm to pass. Torrents of driving rain fall from the cloven skies into the storm-tossed heavens below, goes one traditional song. A deluge descends from the sundered skies into the raging gale below. There is even some evidence that Polynesian sailors reached the coast of South America, probably in the region of modern Colombia. These explorers may have returned with the sweet potato, which would become a favorite Polynesian crop, although it may have also arrived naturally, and brought with them traces of South American DNA that entered their gene pool from about the year 1200, 3 centuries before Columbus would reach the landmass from the other side. One recent genomic study concluded, "We find conclusive evidence for prehistoric contact of Polynesian individuals with Native American individuals around 1200 CE, contemporaneous with the settlement of remote Oceania." There is some debate about exactly when these intrepid Polynesian adventurers arrived on Easter Island. For a long time, it was assumed that settlers had arrived sometime in the 4th to 5th centuries, around the same time that Hawaii was settled. But today, most researchers believe that Rapa Nui wasn't settled until around 1200 CE. An ancient piece of Rapa Nui folklore credits the settlement of the island to a Polynesian king called Hotu Matua, who is led to the island by the dream vision of a prophet named Haumaka. "The dream soul of Haumaka continued her journey and went ashore," goes the story. The soul travels around the island, naming each part of it in turn, and when Haumaka wakes, he goes to tell his king what he has seen. Haumaka went to tell the king about the dream. When he arrived there, he told his dream. He described the dream in detail, including all lands his dream soul had seen. Amazed by the story, the king organizes a great expedition to find the island and settle there. "When you speak to the young men," the king says, "tell them that these orders are from me, the orders of King Matua. Tell them that they have only 1 year to finish building the canoe and to launch it." The Rapa Nui settlers packed their canoes with everything that was required for the traditional Polynesian lifestyle. They brought their staple foods, bananas, a root vegetable called taro, sweet potatoes and sugarcane, as well as chickens and another food staple, the Polynesian rat. They also brought saplings of the paper mulberry tree, the fibers of which they used to create textiles. The settlement of the Polynesian islands was the final chapter of the journey of at least 100,000 years and 30,000 kilometers that had taken humanity out of Africa, through Asia and on to the Americas, the last of humanity's great migrations. Easter Island was the final and most remote stop along this journey, and so in some ways, humanity's restless journey ended on these shores. One Polynesian sailor's song gives voice to a lookout on one of these vessels, sighting land in the distance. "Now the far cries of land birds are heard as they swoop into the troughs of the waves upon the horizon. Ha! Now they settle upon a low-lying reef. Now they come to rest upon the land, rising above the ocean's rim." Hotu Matua and his settlers arrived on Easter Island at Anakena, a white coral sand beach on the north of the island. The landscape they would have seen when they disembarked was very different from the one we see today. Far from the bare, grassy slopes first spied by Roggeveen in the 18th century, the island was then covered by a thick forest of tropical palms. If you dig down into the island's soil, you can still see the hollows left by the roots of these trees. Studies of these root molds, as well as pollen analysis, show that when humans arrived on Rapa Nui, the island was home to more than 21 tree species, some of which were large, including at least 3 which grew up to 15 meters or more. One species, now extinct, known as Pascalococcus disperta, or the Easter Island palm, may have been one of the largest palm species in the world, its bulbous trunk capable of reaching more than 25 meters tall and a meter thick. These settlers were farmers, and they soon began to clear the forest, using slash and burn agriculture in order to plant their crops. The sand of Anakena Beach, the site of that first settlement, is particularly good at preserving bone and human remains, and skeletons examined here have given scientists excellent insights into the lives of the ancient Rapa Nui Islanders. For instance, we know that as well as crops, around half of their nutrition came from marine animals, including dolphins, seals, fish, and sea turtles. These turtles were caught by hand by divers, who would swim into the inky depths at night, and whom Polynesian culture revered as heroes. They carved their fish hooks from bone, made ropes from the fibers of the hau tree, and cooked in earth ovens known as umu. "When you build your earth oven," advises one traditional Polynesian song, "be sure that the heap of stones glows with the intense heat of the fire which you have built. Make yourself over into an assiduous and capable workman, O my son." They were ingenious and drew on inherited knowledge contained in the songs of their ancestors, and they spread quickly across the small landmass until the whole of Rapa Nui was fully populated with as many as 4,000 people, and its forest cover was cleared. Ever since the story of Easter Island entered into the popular imagination in the Western world, one particular narrative has dominated. It began with European explorers from as early as 1786, was propagated by Victorian and 20th century anthropologists, and finally popularized by authors such as the scientist Jared Diamond in his 2005 book, Collapse. In this narrative, the inhabitants of Easter Island were the architects of their own demise. Their population boomed until the island could no longer support their numbers. They cut down their trees for firewood, construction material, and supposedly to use as scaffolds and rollers in the monomaniacal pursuit of transporting their large numbers of enormous statues. The loss of trees destroyed the fertility of the island's soil, and productivity collapsed. Along with the collapse of the island's ecology, the complex and centralized society that had carved the hundreds of stone statues began to fall apart. Starvation ran rampant, and this led to a period of violent civil war and even cannibalism. Shortly before the arrival of the Europeans in 1722, this story goes, the whole of Rapa Nui society had come apart, and only a few hundred survivors were left. "In just a few centuries," Diamond writes, "the people of Easter Island wiped out their forest, drove their plants and animals to extinction, and saw their complex society spiral into chaos." The archaeologists Paul Barn and John Flenley go even further, viewing the island's deforestation as an indictment of the entire human race. "The person who felled the last tree could see that it was the last tree, but he or she still felled it. This is what is so worrying. Humankind's covetousness is boundless. Its selfishness appears to be genetically inborn." In the latter half of the 20th century, as we became increasingly concerned about our own industrial society's destructive impact on our environment, the story of Easter Island gained widespread appeal as a cautionary tale. The island in the middle of the ocean seemed like a perfect microcosm of our planet suspended in the void of space, while the stone statues were allowed to become emblems of human folly, our pride, and our desire always to build bigger and better than our neighbors. But this narrative rests on some questionable assumptions. The first of these is that the island was deforested due to the greed of its inhabitants and their maniacal obsession with statue building. Second, that the loss of the forest led to societal collapse. Third, that the society collapsed at all, at least before contact with the outside world. As we will see, None of these are supported by the evidence. Virtually as soon as they arrived, the Rapa Nui Islanders began carving the monuments that would one day make them famous around the world. Stone statues are common on islands across the Polynesian world, but no other island can compete with the size or the incredible number of the Easter Island statues, which its people call Mo'ai. The statues are known for their large, broad noses and strong chins, their brooding brows and deep eye slits. The Easter Islanders called them Aringa Ora Ata Tepuna, that is, the living faces of the holy ancestors. And more than 1,000 of them have been documented around the island. Of these, 288 Mo'ai stand along the coastline on monolithic stone platforms called ahu. These ahu are themselves impressive undertakings, built of enormous stones, cut and assembled so precisely that not even a razor blade can fit in the gaps. The Mo'ai stand with their backs to the sea, their deep-set expressive eyes staring inland over the fields and hills of Rapa Nui. Almost all of the statues are carved from tuff, a stone formed from volcanic ash which is slowly compacted into solid rock, although 14 have been found carved from the harder basalt. Tuff is relatively soft and easy to carve, and has been used for construction since ancient times. It can be seen in buildings such as Rome's Colosseum. Most of the Mo'ai were carved in a quarry on the outer cliff edge of the Rano Raraku crater, a volcanic caldera on the lower slopes of Maunga Terawaka, the island's largest extinct volcano. The crater is 700 meters across, formed of ash and pieces of volcanic tuff thrown up in an ancient explosion, ringed by cliffs 160 meters high. The islanders chipped the Mo'ai directly from the bedrock here with a hard basalt chisel known as a toki, and hundreds of these tools can be found littered around the quarry, their marks everywhere in the rock walls. One fascinating aspect of this quarry is that there are many incomplete Mo'ai abandoned here, 397 in total, or nearly half of the island's total Mo'ai population. Some Mo'ai were left in cliffs, half excavated, usually because the stoneworkers discovered a seam of hard rock that would have been virtually too difficult to carve away with their stone tools. Others have obvious flaws or cracks, while some have fallen over during the difficult act of raising them. Other Mo'ai were simply too ambitious in size. The largest of these, nicknamed El Gigante, is nearly 22 meters tall, the size of a 7-story building, and was left lying on its back, still ensconced in the rock face, and staring forever up at the sky. This enormous statue would weigh an estimated 270 tons if fully carved out, and it's hard to imagine how the islanders ever intended to move it. It's been speculated that some of the larger Mo'ai may have been intended to stay in the rock face, perhaps keeping guard over the quarry. Some of them seem to be peacefully sleeping in the grottos carved out of the cliff wall, like the reclining Buddhas of Southeast Asia, or the tomb effigies of Europe in the Middle Ages. But it's hard to say with any certainty what the islanders intended for them. The work would doubtless have been slow and painstaking. It's thought that an entire statue could take up to a year for a team of 12 people to carve, but it also may have carried a great deal of status. While these workers were carving a Mo'ai, they weren't laboring in the fields or conducting all manner of other useful tasks, and so their community was investing in their work. Before the carving could even begin, there would have likely been ceremonies and rites that had to take place, chants and incantations designed to summon the protective spirit of the ancestor to inhabit the stone. Many traditional Rapa Nui working songs survive today, and we can imagine the workers singing while they spent long days chipping at the cliff. "Chipping, chipping," cries one traditional Polynesian carving song. "Your hand slips when the rock is very hard. Dubbing away, dubbing away, oh, chipping, chipping." One surviving Rapa Nui folk song even derives its rhythm from the striking together of two stones, which evokes the sounds of the toki tools napping away at the statue. After much arduous work, the whole outline of the moai would be carved out, until it was only attached to the bedrock by a narrow keel along its back. The carvers would then gather up stones and earth underneath to support the moai while they chipped away the final spine of stone. It must have been an incredible moment when that stone umbilical cord was cut and the great statue broke free of its stony slumber. The moai would then have been edged clear of the quarry by large teams and slid down the grassy slope of the volcano. This was one of the most dangerous parts of a moai's journey, and a number of cracked and abandoned statues stand on the slope, looking like an army of stone wanderers marching down from the volcano. These abandoned statues, buried up to their necks in the refuse from the quarry, form some of the most iconic images of Easter Island today, even though these stone heads actually have bodies buried beneath the earth. Once the moai reached the bottom of the hill, the workers would raise it up to a standing position so they could finish carving its back, using soft pumice to wear it smooth and add surface details. Then they would prepare to transport it into its final resting place. We don't know for sure how the ancient islanders moved these vast statues. This question obsessed early visitors to the island, who couldn't see how a people without metal tools, pulleys, or wheels could transport hundreds of them up to 20 kilometers over the island's undulating terrain. The largest successfully transported moai, nicknamed Paro, was nearly 12 meters tall, including his crown, and at 82 tons, weighed more than a Boeing 737 aircraft. When asked by early visitors how their ancestors had moved these statues, the islanders would simply reply, "They walked, and some fell by the way." Foreign visitors assumed this must be a piece of local folklore, a kind of magical thinking that imagined the statues to be the living spirits of the ancestors. Early archaeologists thought that the moai were moved horizontally, perhaps on a wooden sledge or using logs as rollers. But recent research has cast doubt on this theory, and now the idea that the moai had walked has gained greater traction. In the 1980s, researchers Pavel Pavel and Thor Heyerdahl conducted experiments on concrete replicas and even one abandoned moai to see if they could have been moved upright with what they evocatively dubbed the refrigerator method. And their results were promising. "They worked together rhythmically, easily, and without strain," wrote Heyerdahl. "In this manner, the experimental image wriggled forward as if it were walking." At first, they were afraid that the moai might topple forwards, Heyerdahl writes. But Pavel reassured us that the design of the moai was so ingenious that the colossus would have to tilt almost 60 degrees before it would fall. One elderly islander watching the experiment even volunteered an old piece of the Rapa Nui language. "When the moai started to move, the old islanders used the verb neke neke to inch forward by moving the body due to disabled legs or the absence thereof." Littered across Easter Island are the sad shapes of statues that broke during their transportation. These figures have become known as road moai. Interestingly, none of the road moai have eyes. It seems that the islanders waited to carve these until the statues were in place on their platforms, fitting them with white coral and obsidian pupils so that they could truly come alive. This practice has echoes of similar traditions that we can find in Sri Lanka, where the eyes of a temple statue of the Buddha are always the last thing to be painted, in a ritual known as Netramangalaya. There was a special pirit, or protective chant, of passages from the Dharma that accompanied the act, wrote one witness of the practice. What's more, certain artists specialized in the task, and they alone must be employed. While the Buddha's eyes are painted, the artist does not look directly at the statue as a sign of respect, and paints over their shoulder using a mirror. Some form of ritual likely also accompanied the carving of the moai eyes too. The road moai also contain a number of crucial clues about how the statues were transported. In recent years, a team of archaeologists led by veteran Rapa Nui researchers Terry Hunt and Carl Lipo conducted a comprehensive study on the positions and locations of each road moai. They discovered that when road moai were found on uphill paths, they usually lay on their backs, and when the cracked statues were abandoned on downhill paths, they usually lay on their fronts. On flat ground, it was more like 50-50. This suggests that the statues were not dragged horizontally on wooden rollers, but were indeed transported upright, as Pavel and Heyerdahl believed. Once this detail had been noticed, other curiosities about the road moai fell into place. They had bulkier lower halves and rounder bellies than their upright cousins, which had puzzled researchers for a long time. But Hunt and Lipo's theory made sense of these features. The islanders designed the moai in two phases. In the first transportation phase, the moai were bottom-heavy, like a bowling pin. And once in place on the platforms, they were carved into their more slender and elegant final shape. Lipo and Hunt proposed that the statues were raised upright and rocked back and forth by teams of islanders with three ropes, one on either side, and a third stabilizing the statue from behind, so that the statues would have appeared to walk across the ground. In 2012, they even put their theory into practice, using a 5-ton replica of some of the smaller moai on the island. Their team was able to successfully transport the moai nearly 100 meters in just 40 minutes, and with a team of only 18 people. If this is indeed how the statues were moved, it must have been an incredible sight. There would likely have been a large amount of communal ceremonial activity around the walking of these statues too, with people coming from all over the island to watch, sing and dance and perform rites. And with the largest moai weighing more than 80 tons, the thundering of its movements must have made the ground shake. During the weeks that it took to transport one of these statues, it must have felt like a god really had come down to earth. The question over how the moai were moved has great implications for the traditional narrative of Easter Island's ecocide. If Lipo and Hunt are correct and the statues were walked into place, then the islanders wouldn't have needed trees to move them, and the part of the collapse narrative relating to the moai comes into question. Walking the moai did not require vast amounts of timber for wooden sleds, rollers, or sliders, they conclude. It was not a reckless mania for moai that exhausted the island's forest and tipped the ecological scales toward catastrophe. So what did happen to Easter Island's trees? Undoubtedly, much of the forest was cut down by humans, but they didn't do this unconsciously or foolishly. They did it for the same reason that people in Iceland or England cut down much of their forests, because they were farmers. The Rapa Nui, like all Polynesians, farmed energy-rich foods like sweet potatoes, taro, and sugarcane, which were vastly more productive than whatever food they could have gathered from the forest. So much of the deforestation was controlled and conscious, and improved the quality of people's lives. It's also clear from the earliest Dutch accounts that the Rapa Nui didn't cut down the last tree. In fact, one of Roggeveen's crew members, Carl Friedrich Behrens, writes that all the country is under cultivation, and we saw in the distance whole tracts of woodland. This loss of biodiversity did present several significant challenges. With reduced tree cover, the ocean winds and storms threatened to blow away the topsoil, and salt spray from the sea effectively salted the earth in coastal regions. But the islanders reacted to these challenges with ingenuity. Archaeologists have found evidence of areas where the Rapa Nui planted and cultivated groves of palm trees, probably for their materials. One of the Dutch officers on Roggeveen's voyage reported on the wide variety of uses the islanders had for palm leaves, which must have come from somewhere. And Roggeveen himself witnessed groves of fruit trees. It was now deemed advisable to go to the other side of the island, he wrote, whereto the king or head chief invited us, as being the principal place of their plantations and fruit trees, for all the things they brought to us of that kind were fetched from that quarter. The Rapa Nui began farming using a technique known as rock mulching, which has arisen in other cultures that farm in water-poor places. This involves laying rock beds which prevent the soil from washing or blowing away, also reducing the amount of water evaporated by the sun. These rock gardens also increase the amount of nutrients available to the growing plants, as the rainwater flows over the rocks and carries minerals to the roots. There's strong evidence that the Rapa Nui people also cultivated crops underground. Easter Island has one of the largest systems of volcanic caves in the world, and the islanders' relationship with the caves goes back to the first known moment of their history. When their original founder, Hotu Matua, first disembarked on Anakena Beach, the myth describes him lodging in one of these caves. They went on land, sat down, stretched out, and dried in the sun, goes the story. They went on land, turned around, and climbed up together to the cave Pu Pakakina. There they stayed. Some of these caves can stretch for 3 or 4 kilometers and are present beneath more than 30% of the island's territory. As the forests of Rapa Nui retreated, its people started cultivating sizable gardens in the parts of the caves that received light. Here they could grow sweet potato, yam, and taro, sheltered from the Pacific winds. Above ground, they also sheltered crops using circular rock walls called manavai that could be up to 2 meters tall and also reduced the amount of water runoff and concentrated nutrients in the soil. Archaeologists have identified over 2,500 of these circular rock gardens around the island, although it's likely that this is only a fraction of the original number. Studies have shown that even today, with no active maintenance being done on them, these rings of stones are still operating as designed by the ancient gardeners. Levels of phosphorus and potassium, crucial minerals for plants, are much higher inside the manavai than in the soil outside. With their rock gardening techniques, the Rapa Nui were able to make the land much more productive after the forest was cleared than it was before. Far from the barren landscape they had anticipated from afar, when Roggeveen and Behrens got ashore, they both described the islanders bringing them various foods, all wrapped in palm leaves. Women as well as children brought palm branches, red and white streamers and various kinds of fruits, Indian figs, large nuts, sugarcane, roots, fowls, alive, boiled and roast. In fact, studies done on the skeletons of islanders from around the time of contact show that they suffered less from malnutrition than the average European. They happily fed the sailors and didn't make any attempt to beg for food from the newcomers. They were much more interested in the Europeans' hats, and one brave islander even climbed through a porthole on Roggeveen's ship to steal a tablecloth. In fact, it was the Europeans, suffering from malnutrition after weeks at sea, who begged the islanders for food, giving them linens in exchange for 60 chickens and 30 bunches of bananas. Decades later, in 1786, sources from a French expedition likewise described a land that appeared to be flourishing, contrary to the reports they had heard from others. Instead of meeting with men exhausted by famine, I found, on the contrary, a considerable population, with more beauty and grace than I afterwards met in any other island, and a soil which, with very little labour, furnished excellent provisions, and in an abundance more than sufficient for the consumption of the inhabitants. A key part of the starvation narrative is the assumption that the island descended into a period of brutal conflict once resources ran scarce. But if resources were actually abundant, can we also question this assumption? The folklore of the islanders does record a period of warfare, during which two ethnic groups on the island were supposed to have clashed. These were known as the Hanau Epe, either stout people or long ears, and Hanau Momoko, meaning either thin people or short ears. But there is little evidence of organized warfare on the island, and this piece of oral folklore may simply be a legend. Much more reliable is the archaeological record. The evidence of a sustained conflict is usually hard to miss. For example, on Fiji, another Pacific island 7,000 kilometers from Rapa Nui, archaeologists have found the remains of hilltop forts and fortified towns. Tahitians constructed massive war canoes for inter-island raids, write Lipo and Hunt, and Hawaiian chiefdoms battled each other in long-standing wars involving hundreds of warriors with fearsome battle clubs. The signs of war include increased number of weapons, increased building of defensive structures, and skeletal remains that bear the marks of violence. Like the Maya and the Aztecs, the islanders of Rapa Nui made blades called matar from the black volcanic glass obsidian. Some researchers long contended that the profusion of these blades on the island points to a mass production of weaponry. But studies of the blades themselves have found that their edges were mostly covered in vegetable matter, sweet potato and taro. Morphometric analysis shows that matar were not specifically designed for interpersonal violence, but were general-purpose tools that may have been used for peaceful tasks. These matar were found in the highest concentrations around the islanders' rock gardens, where they were most likely used for everyday tasks like food preparation. In a historical zone of conflict, archaeologists would expect to see skeletons missing their heads, for instance, or skulls with arrowheads inside, or broken, fractured, or damaged bones bearing weapon marks. But studies of remains on Easter Island have shown that the islanders led a remarkably peaceful existence. Only 2.5% of the skeletons studied have been found to have suffered any trauma, and almost all of these injuries were non-lethal. The people had, to judge by appearances, no weapons, wrote Behrens in 1722. Although, as I remarked, they relied in case of need on their gods or idols, which stand erected all along the seashore in great numbers, before which they fall down and invoke them. In the search for defensive structures, archaeologists have also been frustrated. The small Pacific island of Rapa Iti, 5 times smaller than Easter Island, has no fewer than 14 hilltop fortresses, with watchtowers and walls, ditches and wooden palisade fences. Here we find weapons and human remains bearing the marks of violence. On Easter Island, no such strong evidence exists. In fact, Rapa Nui was notable for its lack of violence. So another of our popular assumptions about Easter Island crumbles. We are left having to explain how Rapa Nui's culture could possibly have been less violent than many other comparable societies, and certainly less violent than life in any European city of the time. We may never fully explain this. Some have speculated that the small size of the island, with close family connections between communities, made conflict risky and difficult to countenance. Some historians have argued that the erection of the Moai themselves may have helped to prevent conflict by allowing the island's communities to compete for dominance and status in a non-violent way. Another bonding practice may have emerged in the remarkable ritual known as the Birdman competition. The later history of the island is dominated by the cult of a mysterious shapeshifter known as the Tangata Manu, or Birdman. This ceremonial figure, with a human body and the head and wings of a bird, is depicted in cave paintings. Each year, the men of Rapa Nui took part in a test of strength and daring that called on them to become the human embodiment of the Birdman for that year. The contestants who competed to become the Birdman had a simple enough task. Off the southwest coast of Rapa Nui, on a tiny islet, a rocky outcrop known as Motu Nui is home to several species of birds, including the sooty or black tern. These were imbued with both practical and mystical importance for Polynesian sailors, and it's not hard to see how they also assumed a powerful religious significance. The Birdman contest took place during the laying season. Young men would swim out to Motu Nui, a distance of about a kilometer, through choppy, shark-filled seas and powerful currents. They carried with them a few days' supplies under their arm, wrapped in a bundle of reeds called a pura. They then had to climb ashore and scramble up through the flocks of cackling seabirds and search through their nests, looking for the first egg of the season. Sometimes they would have to remain on the island for days before they found one. But once they claimed their precious prize, they had to swim with it all the way back to Rapa Nui and climb the sheer 300-meter cliff of the volcano Ranu Kau. The men of the celebrating clan carried them to the mainland, swimming with them in baskets bound round the forehead, writes Catherine Routledge. They were then taken in procession round the island. Each year, the first man to complete this triathlon event would be crowned that year's Birdman. We might speculate that allowing warrior-age men to battle it out in this test of strength, agility, and stamina every year may have played a role in reducing violence and feuds on the island. The evidence therefore suggests that there was no starvation and no widespread warfare on Easter Island. This might leave us asking, where did we even get the idea that their society had collapsed? There exists in the midst of the great ocean, in a region where nobody goes, a mysterious and isolated island, wrote the 19th century French seafarer and artist Pierre Loti. The island is planted with monstrous great statues, the work of I don't know what race, today degenerate or vanished, its great remains an enigma. Confusion about who had built the statues of Easter Island was one of the consistent themes of European exploration of Rapa Nui. It was considered a mystery. How could a seemingly Stone Age society of cave dwellers have produced stonework to rival the majesty of the pyramids of Giza on a solitary island so incredibly remote? We've encountered this kind of thinking a number of times over the course of this book. Whether it's assuming that the city of Angkor was built by the Roman Emperor Trajan, or that the Mayan pyramids of Tikal were built by the citizens of Atlantis, European explorers have often struggled to believe that the indigenous people of non-European lands were capable of complex and impressive constructions. Only a so-called advanced civilization could have built these things, this kind of circular thinking goes. And the people living here don't look like an advanced civilization. In fact, what appeared to early European visitors to be an enigma wasn't anything of the sort. The stone statues of Easter Island hadn't been built by some vanished ancient culture, but by the people who lived there still, and seemed to those Europeans to be so simple. But in fact, a collapse would occur on Rapa Nui. Only it wasn't because they cut down the trees. There is one event in its history that I believe encapsulates the complete destruction that ultimately descended on Easter Island. The toppling, in just a few years, of every one of its standing statues. For centuries, the islanders had loved and revered the Moai that their ancestors had spent generations carving and transporting. In 1722, Roggeveen recounted what he saw of the islanders' devotion to these statues. They kindle fire in front of certain remarkably tall stone figures they set up, and thereafter, squatting on their heels with heads bowed down, they bring the palms of their hands together and alternately raise and lower them. On the 15th of November 1770, 48 years after the first European visit, two Spanish ships landed and spent 5 days on the island, performing a very thorough survey of its coast. They rechristened it Isla de San Carlos and claimed it on behalf of King Charles III of Spain. They also ceremoniously erected 3 wooden crosses and a Spanish flag on a hill. At that moment, it seems that all the island's 200 erected statues were still standing. But just 4 years later, the British explorer Captain James Cook sailed past the island and found a much different situation. Cook's diary entry for the 17th of March 1774 gives his account of the impoverished state of the island. This is undoubtedly the same island as was seen by Roggeveen on April 1722. Although the descriptions given of it by the authors of that voyage do by no means correspond with it now. No nation will ever contend for the honour of the discovery of Easter Island, as there is hardly an island in this sea which affords less refreshments and conveniences for shipping than it does. Nature has hardly provided it with anything fit for man to eat or drink, and as the natives are but few, and may be supposed to plant no more than sufficient for themselves. According to Cook, the population at this time only numbered 600 or 700. He also noticed that the islanders now carried weapons when approaching foreign visitors, wooden clubs and spears topped with obsidian points. But the final tragic detail was the fact that in the 4 years since the Spanish expedition, virtually all the standing Moai on the island had been toppled. On the east side of the island, near the sea, they met with 3 platforms of stonework, or rather the ruins of them. On each had stood 4 of those large statues, but they were all fallen down from 2 of them, and also 1 from the 3rd. Every one except 1 were broken by the fall and otherwise defaced. By 1838, every single coastal Moai had been taken down. Now the only standing statues were those abandoned on the slopes below Rano Waraku. What happened to cause the islanders to take up weapons? What reduced their population so drastically? And what made them turn so dramatically against their gods? The answer may lie in the very event that opened this chapter, the arrival of 3 Dutch sails on the horizon on Easter Day, 1722. At the sight of the enormous ships dropping anchor some way off the coast, the islanders must have felt how we would feel If a vast alien spaceship were to one day materialize over one of our cities, a mix of fear and wonder, a sense that the world would never quite be the same again. They selected one of their number as an envoy, and in my view, it's not unlikely that he would have been the winner of the most recent Birdman competition, the island's champion and protector. This man got in his canoe and rowed out to meet the strange vessels. When he approached, he saw that there were men on board, and he waved to them. The Dutch Captain Roggeveen wrote about this incredible encounter. "This hapless creature seemed to be very glad to behold us, and showed the greatest wonder at the build of our ship. He took special notice of the tautness of our spars, the stoutness of our rigging and running gear, the sails, the guns, which he felt all over with minute attention, and with everything else that he saw. When the image of his own features was displayed before him in a mirror, he started suddenly back, and then looked towards the back of the glass, apparently in the expectation of discovering there the cause of the apparition. After we had sufficiently beguiled ourselves with him, and he with us, we started him off again in his canoe towards the shore. But when the Dutchmen got ashore, Barons paints a darker picture. It's clear from his and Roggeveen's accounts that the Europeans were nervous when they stepped ashore. They had heard stories of violent encounters with Pacific Islanders, and despite their guns and cannons, they were afraid of the Rapa Nui. The natural curiosity and boldness of the islanders made matters worse. When the Dutch got ashore, the Rapa Nui pressed around them, grabbing at their hats and clothes, and even touching the guns they carried. It's not clear which Dutchman shot first, but soon a burst of fire tore into the crowd. Barons recounts what happened next, as he recognized a familiar face among the murdered islanders. Many of them were shot at this juncture, and among the slain lay the man who had been with us before, at which we were much grieved. In order to obtain possession of the bodies, they congregated in great numbers, bringing with them presents of various kinds of fruits and vegetables, in order that we might more readily surrender to them their slain. The consternation of these people was by no means abated. Even their children's children in that place will, in times to come, be able to recount the story of it. Just as Barons writes, the story of this violent encounter must indeed have reverberated through the history of the Rapa Nui. We can assume it would have rocked their sense of the world. The islanders didn't carry weapons, instead relying on their gods to protect them. We can only imagine what would happen to this belief system when multiple islanders were killed with these mysterious weapons, when the killers then walked around the island, even approaching the supposedly protective statues before sailing away. How could the Rapa Nui's belief in the protective power of the Moai survive this encounter? Worse, the Europeans' bullets were not their deadliest legacy. Just as in other encounters in the Americas, the Europeans had brought their usual stowaways, viruses and bacteria to which the islanders' immune systems had never been exposed. On other, better observed Polynesian islands, the reduction in population after first European contact was as much as 90%. On Rapa Nui, the Dutch sailors' close contact with the islanders, along with the linens they traded for food, would have been vectors of disease transmission. It's possible that after Roggeveen's initial contact, the population of the island may have crashed to only a few hundred. The population would only just have recovered by the time that, 48 years later, the Spaniards arrived and delivered a whole new dose of invisible death to the islanders. The causes of this epidemic would have been incomprehensible to the Rapa Nui, and in fact the Europeans of the time knew little more. They believed illnesses were caused by miasmas or bad night air, those being the day's prevailing theories. As whole families sickened and died, the Rapa Nui must have again believed that the Moai had failed them, or worse, turned against them. And one by one, they began to bring them down. One remarkable fact about Easter Island is that it may be one of the few places on Earth where writing was independently invented, alongside only Sumerian cuneiform, Chinese characters, Mayan glyphs, and perhaps Egyptian hieroglyphics and the Indus Valley. A script called Rongo Rongo has been found on just a few dozen surviving wooden objects and tablets, usually carved with a shark's tooth or a piece of obsidian. These tablets were all plundered by private collectors in the late 19th century and are now scattered in museums and private collections around the world. Today, none remain on Easter Island. Every modern attempt to decipher Rongo Rongo has failed, and the script stands as one of the great mysteries of Rapa Nui. The island legends state that Hotu Matua brought the wooden tablets with him when he landed on Rapa Nui, but this seems unlikely. There is no known tradition of writing anywhere else in Polynesia. It's been argued that Rongo Rongo writing could be a more modern invention, that the islanders saw Europeans reading and writing and were inspired to create their own script. If this were the case, then the written language of Rongo Rongo would have emerged, flourished, and fallen into oblivion, all within a space of less than 100 years. However, one of the symbols shows, clearly and unambiguously, the distinctive bulbous shape of a Jubea palm tree, a species that went extinct on the island at least 70 years before European contact, showing that Rongo Rongo was developed during a time when these monster palms still grew over Rapa Nui. In 1864, a French churchman, Eugène Hérault, arrived on the island and described seeing quantities of these writing tablets, although the islanders no longer valued them as repositories of knowledge. In every hut, one finds wooden tablets or sticks covered in several sorts of hieroglyphic characters. They are depictions of animals unknown on the island, which the natives draw with sharp stones. Each figure has its own name, but the scant attention they pay to these tablets leads me to think that these characters, remnants of some primitive writing, are now for them a habitual practice, which they keep without seeking its meaning. Other European visitors in the later 19th century reported seeing islanders using the tablets as reels for their fishing lines and as tools for fire starting, and by this time, none could agree on how to read them. Whatever knowledge was held on the Rongo Rongo tablets, it had been lost. The reason for this can be found in the tragic final stage of Rapa Nui's collapse. By 1789, maps were being printed that showed exactly where Easter Island was. In the 19th century, the island became a common stopover for ships who wanted to pick up food and other supplies. But as time went by, the visits became more sinister in intent. In 1805, a group of American sealers, finding themselves short-handed, landed on Easter Island and kidnapped 22 Rapa Nui people, forcing them to work on their ship and keeping them in shackles below deck. This was the beginning of increasingly organized slave-taking raids against the island, and traffic to the South Pacific was only to increase as North Atlantic whale populations were hunted towards extinction and whalers increasingly ventured into the southern seas. Soon the Rapa Nui were understandably hostile to any foreigner who tried to land there. When a Russian expedition tried to land in 1816, the Rapa Nui pelted the sailors with stones. The slave raids reached their peak in the 1860s, when large, heavily armed expeditions began arriving from Peru. They would scour the island, rounding up everyone they could find. More than 1,500 Rapa Nui people were captured in these raids, and only a few who managed to hide were spared. The Rapa Nui people were transported to Peru and put to work on plantations or as domestic servants. Eventually, after a public outcry, the Peruvian government was forced to repatriate them, though this only led to further tragedy. Some of the dozen or so islanders who had survived enslavement and the voyage home were infected with smallpox, and before long this spread through the remaining island population. This would be the final death knell for the island's distinctive and beautiful culture. Among those taken as slaves were every single one of the priestly class, the only people who could read the Rongo Rongo script. The continuity of songs, myths, and tales that had for centuries carried the folk memory of Rapa Nui was lost. By 1866, there were just 111 adult islanders living on Easter Island. 2 years later, when the HMS Topaz, a 51-gun British frigate of the Royal Navy, landed on Easter Island, the islanders could no longer summon the energy even to throw stones. The British searched the island until they found the most exquisite example of a moai ever carved. One of the only 14 known to have been carved from hard basalt. They put ropes around the statue and dragged it aboard their ship. When a British sailor asked a local what the name of the statue was, they replied that he was Hoa Hakana Naya, which translates to our stolen friend. The statue was presented to Queen Victoria and remains in the British Museum to this day, despite repeated requests by the modern Rapa Nui people for it to be returned. In 1888, Easter Island was annexed by Chile. It was leased to the Williamson Balfour Company, a machinery importer and operator of several flour mills, which turned the whole island into a sheep ranch. Capitalism had arrived on Easter Island. The remaining Rapa Nui were cleared off their lands and moved to the town of Hangaroa on the west coast, where they were ordered to build a 3-meter stone wall around the town, beyond which they were forbidden to set foot. Cut off from their traditional agriculture, the only way for the Rapa Nui to survive was to work as labourers on the sheep ranch. They were now effectively indentured servants on their own island. Rapa Nui's hillsides were grazed by sheep for more than 60 years, and this, more than anything the Rapa Nui had done, destroyed the last remaining trees and stripped the island of its topsoil. One American visitor to the island, a company man named William Thompson, recounted the damage that intensive sheep farming had done to the island's ecology. In other parts of the island may be seen, in places in considerable numbers, a hardwood tree called by the natives Toromiro. These must have flourished well at one time, but are now all, or nearly all, dead and decaying by reason of being stripped of their bark by the flocks of sheep which roam at will all over the island. Looking at the evidence, a new narrative emerges, and we see that the mystery of Easter Island isn't a mystery at all. Rapa Nui was not the site of an ecological suicide, but rather of a genocide. And, to add insult to injury, they would go on to be used as a cautionary tale by the very industrialized society that had destroyed them. The truth is that the islanders didn't foolishly damage their environment and bring about their own downfall. In fact, they made their island garden flourish. Through ingenuity, they built a unique and remarkable visual culture and maintained the peace among their communities. So when we reach for Easter Island as a fable, we should be very careful about our reasons. As we face the challenges of our own time, perhaps we should be asking not what warning we might take from the fate of Easter Island, but what its people might have to teach us. Or, as one Polynesian proverb says, "The seashell sings for him alone who knows how to listen." When she visited in 1913, Catherine Routledge would become the first to complete a full survey of Easter Island's remains. Her and her team conducted extensive excavations, unearthing more than 30 Moai statues, but they also managed to document a number of the myths and oral histories of the islanders. By visiting tribal elders in a leper colony situated north of the now walled town of Hangaroa. Over her stay in the island, Routledge was moved by the windswept ruins of the fallen Moai that still scattered the grassy hills of this land that had lost faith in its gods. "In Easter Island, the past is the present," she wrote. "It is impossible to escape from it. The shadows of the departed builders still possess the land. Voluntarily or involuntarily, the sojourner must hold commune with these old workers, for the whole air vibrates with a vast purpose and energy which has been and is no more. What was it? Why was it? The great works are now in ruins, of many comparatively little remains, but the impression infinitely exceeded anything which had been anticipated. And every day, as the power to see increased, brought with it a greater sense of wonder and marvel. If we were to tell people at home these things," said our sailing master, after being shown the prostrate images on the great burial place of Tongariki, "they would not believe us."